Okay, looks like we are recording here. Welcome, everybody.
Yeah, welcome, folks. Welcome to the February edition of Mike and Scotty Live. And
An
we've got
unprecedented third consecutive month of recording.
it's a beautiful thing.
It is.
And
And before I forget, can we give a shout out to our friend Craig Biesgeier? I mean,
well,
because we have forgotten him the past couple of times, I think.
honestly, I don't know, how much longer he's going to be a friend.
Well, hopefully this will go some to making up for that.
Yeah, I'm a little annoyed at our boy Craig right now, so I'm kidding. Craig knows I love him, even if he's not a Patriots fan.
We don't want to go
So,
there.
no, we're not gonna. That's as far as we're gonna go with that. Having said that, I mentioned to Mike that I've got a bunch of stuff to talk about this month, and I know Mike does too. So,
Scott is jacked and stoked.
yeah, Jack, I'm pumped. What's I forget what that is. That's
Pete Carroll.
the Pete Carroll saying. And by the way, just as an aside, Dr. Vinnie Bumbatz, that was Rodney Dangerfield's doctor.
There you go.
So that
Were we just
was
talking about that?
yesterday, yeah. And
Okay. Well,
we
yesterday was
couldn't
so long ago for
remember.
me.
It was all the way yesterday.
You know what I've been through since yesterday,
Yeah.
so.
Well, and we're gonna jump right into that
Okay.
because Mike spends probably 90% of his time working above the layout.
Right.
And that's a wonderful thing. That's where you want to be,
Yeah,
but
that's where I want to be, exactly.
every once in a while something crops up that makes you go underground, and Mike has spent the last couple of days doing just that with shooting some troubles with a wiring issue. And I guess the good news, Mike, is that as of this afternoon you found the problem. What happened?
I think I did, but I guess I should backtrack a little bit,
Yeah.
and I should also point out, and if you have any thoughts on this, believe me, I'm still all ears. I think, well, who knows what I said last time, but as part of the layout rebuild, I realized that when I reconfigured the track arrangement, what I had ended up with in a couple of spots was a polarity reversal, right? Because when you change how tracks connect with one another, you have a 50-50 shot of that being the case. Something I hadn't really even given much thought about before I did the kaboom, but it quickly reminded me that, oh yeah, this can happen. So I realized that because I had adjacent tracks that I might need to change the polarity on, all connected to the same bus, that the only way to square it away was to run a bus for each track. And I thought, well, while I'm at it, I'll do what I should have done originally back when I converted the layout from DC to DCC and just make it a few different electrical zones and have an on-off toggle for each one so that if I have to debug anything, I can. And I'm thinking, how hard can this be? It's two wires, and I basically disconnected all my feeders. And the way I have traditionally hooked up feeders in the modern times is I'll have the layout live, because the last thing you want to do is hook up a bunch of feeders and then realize one of them's wrong, but you don't know which one it is. So you want to check these things as you go along. So what I've always done, like I was going to say, is have an engine idling on the layout. And the minute you hook up something wrong polarity, engine would cut out, and you know it. And of course, when the NCE system, it just resets itself, and you just get on with life, and you proceed.
Yep.
And that's the way I hooked up all of these feeders. And I did the first two layout segments with nary an issue. So when I went to do this third section, I had a short section of track, maybe five, no more than 6 feet long, that I made to connect two existing portions of the layout together. And this was where the track no longer curved on that viaduct and crossed the aisle on the bridge, but basically just went straight ahead. So while I was building that track, a very non-challenging two pieces of straight track, I dropped feeders for each piece of rail while it was easy to do so, while I was standing inside the bench work, because this track is, more towards the back of the layout. And this section included one of the two behind the wall hidden tracks, one of which represents Vosburgh Tunnel, and the other one is just, a track on the way coming from Allentown. So as I'm hooking up that track, I was fine in the whole hidden section, and I test ran an engine through that section. Engine hadn't run there in over a year, and held my breath, but no problem. Went right through the hidden trackage from the already connected end, and stopped itself up behind Masonite, where I expected it to stop because I had no feeders hooked up. Great.
Okay.
Backed up the engine to the point where there was power and stopped it there and started hooking up my feeders. No problem. Engine doesn't cut out. Hooked up all my feeders. Ran the engine onto that section of track and basically lost control of it. That was the first sign of trouble. And by lost control, I mean the engine was running, but it wouldn't respond to the throttle. So I thought, huh? Decoder problem? Always my first thought based on issues I've had in the distant past. So I just, took the engine off the track, grabbed another engine, put it on the track. Same thing happens. So I thought, maybe the track's dirty. Got out my trusty bright boy and cleaned the track, put an engine back on there. Same thing. And at this time I noticed that when I took the engine off the track, the power pack didn't keep the engine running. So that's what made me think, maybe it's not getting enough voltage to charge the power pack. And maybe because of that, it's not getting enough to get the signals to the decoder in the desired fashion. So I took my meter and put it on the rails in that area, and I had 12 volts less than I had anywhere else on the layout.
Holy cow. You were down almost nothing then.
Well, I'm normally reading, and this is different, so don't get alarmed when I say this, but I'm normally reading about 26 volts on the layout. This is volts AC. So without a true RMS meter, that measurement, the actual number, is meaningless. So there's a place inside the NCE system where you can meter it to make sure it's putting out the correct voltage of about 14 volts, and that's what I have. But what I'm saying is, when you meter the track without a true RMS meter, which apparently I guess is an expensive thing, I hear, you can't, the voltage reading that you're getting isn't actually the voltage reading, so you shouldn't be alarmed when it says 26 volts. But you should be alarmed when it doesn't say the same thing everywhere, because that's really what the way it should be. So I was reading, like 14 volts or 12 volts or whatever it was in this one section. So if I said to you, gee, Scott, what would cause that? What would you say?
A bunny rabbit.
Across the rails?
Yeah,
Yeah.
clearly. Clearly, yeah.
I'd never went
Mike.
into that. You know what I mean? I looked at that and I thought, okay, I know shorts, I know opens, and I've certainly run into my fair share of both of those over time, but I've never run into a voltage drop kind of a thing.
Yeah, that's a head
Of
scratcher.
course, it's AC, you know what I mean? So you have to think about AC differently than you would think about DC, which is what I'm learning. So, of course, the first thing you do is you start trying to solve for X. You're trying to work your way backwards. And I eventually got to the point where I disconnected enough feeders that I was now once again reading correct voltage. So I start hooking up my feeders again because although I was getting correct voltage in the block, what I was not powering up yet was the new section. So I started hooking up the feeders again. And as I'm hooking them up, I'm metering. And as I hooked up certain feeders, there were at least three feeders that when I hooked them up, voltage dropped back down by 12 volts, approximately. So I looked at that and I thought, how is that even possible? Like, in other words, I couldn't come up with a scenario that explained that, so I didn't know what to look for. In fact, I even called my buddy Den Lippert last night because he's got a good DCC brain and a very logical and accomplished troubleshooter and debugger. And we didn't come up with any smoking gun on it. A, he'd never run into that. B, he didn't know what would produce that kind of a scenario. His gut feeling was that it was the only turnout in that block, because like how could it not be?
Right, gotta be, right?
And I didn't disagree, but I reminded him that that turnout had not been disturbed and that it had always worked perfectly in the past. Kind of reminds me of what you were saying about whenever Dick had run into those problems on his layout. It was always in a scenario where, well, it always used to work fine. What the hell just happened?
Right.
So, last night I just kind of at 8 o'clock, I still hadn't had dinner yet, and I just kind of packed it in and said, "All right, you beat me today. I will take this thing up tomorrow." And naturally, probably was dreaming about it all night because that's kind of what happens when I'm trying to debug something and I haven't got a solution.
Yep.
So, when I spoke with you earlier today, I still hadn't solved it. And of course, it didn't help that in our area and yours, we had a major snowstorm, and I was out there plowing last night and shoveling today, and just what you want to be doing instead of working in your basement trying to solve this pressing problem that's keeping you from moving forward.
Sure, yeah.
So, I was I before I was speaking with you, I was actually speaking with Mike Confalone, because I do have a tendency to whine to anybody who'll listen when I'm having a problem like this. And it's useful sometimes because the process of trying to describe what you're running into often can make you think of something that you might not have otherwise thought of, right? So that's why I did it with Mike, and that's why I did it with you earlier. And between the two conversations, it did get me thinking, And usually when you're doing debug and you're just not coming up with anything, my experience has been it's always because you're making an assumption that by rights should absolutely be true, but for some reason it's not. And if everything revolves around that being true and it's not, all of your debug is out the window. And that's really what it was. So, and I got to give my buddy Den Lippert credit here. He was right. It was something to do with the turnout. So, think about how you normally wire a turnout. If it's a dead frog turnout and it's powerable, I drop a feeder from the frog. And then you know that you've got to have the two rails coming out of the frog powered because you're not necessarily on an isolated turnout running the power right through there. So I usually drop feeders on the opposite side of the frog to power up those tracks. And the tracks are usually continuous, right, from the outside rails, the stock rails.
Sure.
So if it's a separate segment of rail, I'm still dropping a feeder to those rails to ensure continuity. And so you got to figure on a turnout, you have minimum four wires and usually five or six, depending upon the construction of the turnout. So in the course of my rewiring, I had of course disconnected all of those feeders. And the feeders, I like to color code my feeders. I'm using a lighter color for one side and a darker color for the other side, which helps you for the most part hook them up right without having to think too hard about it. Of course, that presupposes you get that right. And wouldn't you know, and of course this turnout was installed eons ago, right? Who knows how many, 5, 10 years ago? Who knows how long ago this turnout was installed? Apparently, when I installed the feeders originally, I had swapped the color code on it and fixed it
Okay.
way back when, fixed it then. But when I went to rehook it up, hadn't remembered that, hadn't noted that in any fashion, because who thinks they're going to have to like rewire all of their feeders? So I hooked it up according to the color code, and as it turns out, one of them needed to be reversed in order to be correct. So right before this podcast, I discovered that and wired up the turnout itself properly, and I have normal voltage in that block, and it should enable me, in theory, to march down the rest of the way and hook up all the feeders and have the polarity on. Now, the one thing that I don't understand, I would like this explained to me, and if any of our listeners know the answer to this, or if you know the answer to this,
I guarantee you I don't, but go ahead.
email me, post it on the podcast group, whatever. How could I have a feeder on a turnout hooked up to the wrong polarity and not have a short?
Funny you should say that.
Oh, so maybe you do know?
Well, I've got a similar, I had a similar issue. So when on my layout, Dick Elwell came in and wired up the DCC for me. And there were a number of reversing loops in the layout. So, he had the reversing circuits. And so wired everything up, and everything was running fine for a period of a couple of months, no problems. And then all of a sudden, in one of the reversing loops, with all but one locomotive, I started to get a short. As soon as I'd cross the gaps, it would short out and shut everything down.
But one loco, it didn't do that?
One locomotive would run through with no problem.
Love this. All right.
So I said to Dick, I said, Dick, how can this be?
How is that possible? Yep, if I had a dollar for every time I asked myself that question.
And of course, he didn't know the answer either. And he said, well, you check to see if your gaps are closed, go
Right.
through all the regular stuff. So a couple of weeks later, he comes down. And I said, would you take, see what you think? Because he's saying I'm crazy. So now I'm showing him. He takes a look at the reversing circuit, and it's wired backwards. So,
Why did the one loco work fine?
who knows?
Oh, that's the wrong answer.
Who knows? To this day, I have no answer.
See, there's too much voodoo when it comes to this kind of thing, if you ask me.
It's magic. It is Hogwarts magic. And there's no answer. To no one has been able to tell me. He couldn't tell me.
Right.
Dick has wired a million layouts.
What are we learning here?
That it's magic.
Jeez.
Well, so he rewired
I
it.
tell my computer customers, this is why I have no hair. I don't want my hobby to be that way.
Right. So, he rewired it. Everything ran fine, including that one locomotive. And the moral of the story is that there are some things that you will just never know the answer to. Your problem being one, maybe one of them. Just move on. Get back on the upper side of the layout,
Yeah.
and just say, hey, it's solved.
I hate mysteries like that, because
Yeah, I
they often
know.
come back to haunt you at another time.
Yeah, no, I there's no question. And if not, Mike, it's just the nature of the beast. If not this problem, something else will crop up. It's just the way it is.
Yeah, it's almost like no matter what, how much you think you know, and how experienced you are, and how careful you are, there's always going to be something like this. So I guess this anecdote might be useful for the million other people who have had similar experiences and think that it's them. I guess apparently it happens to everybody sooner or later. And it's funny, I had mentioned Craig earlier, and he and I were actually exchanging a couple of postings about this on, one of the many Facebook groups that we share membership on. And he and another fellow were kind of weighing in on this, And he had a similar problem one time, ended up just taking all of his feeders off and starting over, and the problem went away, and he never did know what the problem was. So I hate to say it, but it's highly likely this is going to be one of those. But I think the question of why didn't I get a short when I had one feeder connected wrong, I think that's answerable. I think somebody is going to know the answer to that, somebody who actually knows electricity. There's a big difference between knowing how to hook things up properly, and I certainly understand that. I mean, I've wired whole houses. But it's quite another to understand why some of this weirdness works that way. And I think somebody who really understands, electronics, and that's a different thing. I think they could explain it, and I'd love to know the answer to that.
I wonder too. With some of the DCC circuit boards, what the quality control is like, and if there just aren't some bugs that are.
Well, they're little computers, so I mean that really wouldn't be beyond believability for me. I mean, I certainly can concede that point. But I don't know that. I mean, I don't know. This doesn't feel like a DCC issue. This feels like a, if you knew something about electricity issue, you'd understand this kind of thing.
No,
And
I.
obviously, if I do get an answer to it, it's something we'll talk about.
All right. Well, congratulations on at least solving that problem
Well, I am
and
cautiously optimistic, and of course, I
yeah.
don't want to declare victory until I have completed all of the hookups in that block and everything's just fine, and I could just look at it and say, okay, now I can get on with life.
Well, you'll know soon enough, right?
Yep. And what's 2 days out of your life?
Well, the way you work, it's a lot, but
Well, it really throws my schedule off. There's no question about it, 'cause you can't plan for this kind of stuff.
no, not at all, not at all. Well, I'm sure by the next time we record, we'll know definitively, and you can update us.
I sure hope so.
So I got a surprise today, Mike.
Okay.
We talk a lot about, as prototype modelers, the amount of research that's required to do it right. And regardless of where your love of the hobby lies, and we all kind of pick our poison. To nobody's surprise, mine is structures. And 3 years ago, geez, 4 years ago now. I had photographed and begun the process of building a prototype model of the Archer Rubber Company, which
That was 4 years ago? How's that
that's
possible? It seems like you were just telling me about this the other day.
yeah no it was 4 years ago
Like, if you had asked me, I would have said, yeah, that was last year, right?
well it kind of feels that way, and I just surprised myself when I did the ran the numbers in my head. But it's the research process, as is if it's done right, it's time consuming, and it's detail oriented, which we also talked about earlier. But I measured the whole building to the degree that I could access it. And it just weren't there were some places that were inaccessible.
Sure.
Photographed it, built the mock-up,
Now, was it not operating at that time, or was it a going concern?
No, it was operating at the
Okay.
time, and consulted with Dick because it was a project that was going on his layout. We changed it from a wood structure to a brick structure, which changed some of the architecture and design. He ended up building two versions of it, one that we felt didn't really fit with the layout, and actually is now on Mike Confluence layout.
Oh, that was a long time ago. Okay.
And the final version, which has been on his layout now for 2 years, it is the
Dick's layout.
Dick's layout. Yeah, it's the topic of an upcoming article in Model Railroader magazine, and it's opened up a whole new set of operation possibilities on Dick's layout. It's it you know it's but you know I think Dick's kind of finishing touches really set the stage for the success of that building. But as I mentioned, the prototype is in Milford, Mass, and I had to run an errand to Milford today, which is about 7 or 8 miles up the road from me. And just the way the streets fall, you go in to the center of town one way and follow the one-way streets out the other, which takes you past the Archer Rubber Company, which is now being torn down.
Wow.
And I almost drove off the road. As I drove up, in fact, I was thinking on the way to Milford, I'd really like to build the actual wood version of this building because it's just a really, really cool version. I didn't really love changing it to brick, but it became a paper mill, and paper mills are ostensibly brick, so it had to be that way. But I was thinking about it all the way to Milford, and was kind of looking forward to my annual drive-by. And as I got close, I thought, why? How is it I can see the inside of this building? And the
How are you
reason
supposed to see the inside?
is because they're in the process of tearing it down, and they've got cranes out there. A portion of the building now is totally gone.
Did it have a fire or something?
I could. It didn't appear to be, but. On the other hand, Mike, I mean, this building was just, it's talk about a fire trap. Just this big, old, rambling, giant wood structure that was built at the turn of the last century. And the products that they were manufacturing there were using caustic chemicals. They manufactured, among other things, they manufactured rubber products for the military, life vests, life rafts, ponchos. They actually at one time manufactured the liners for caskets.
Jeez.
The place is just a brown. It's sitting on a brown field. It's a giant mess. The rear of the building, which had just an incredible amount of character, was almost completely overgrown with weeds, and just had not a speck of paint on the building in the back.
Maybe they weren't
So,
even using the entire building at that point.
I don't know whether the company moved or went out of business, but I'm not surprised that they're tearing it down in retrospect. But it was certainly a surprise to see it in that state today, as I was just thinking about it.
Well, that
So,
model was no doubt not a small model, right? So, how did it come about being able to have a place on Dick's layout? Because that time that I went there, it just seemed like the whole thing was done. So, like, how did he put that in there?
he's kind of at a point now where, anything that he does, he's sacrificing aisle space, and that's.
Ah.
The aisle space for a layout that operates to the degree that Dick's does, aisle space is paramount.
He had generous aisle space, I thought.
Yeah, and you know what?
And that's part of
Most
what made it very relaxing to operate there.
well,
You weren't
and
climbing over people all the time.
if you're going to accommodate 8 operators at a time, you need that kind of space, or otherwise, you're rubbing bums with other guys.
That we found the same thing. In other words, we found that there was an optimal number of operators both at Mike C's layout and at mine, and I think Neil's going to find the same thing. And that if you have too few, well, it's not that big a deal. You just maybe not don't run the whole schedule. But if you have too many, the people just kind of congregate and rubberneck and chatter and get in each other's way, and it's really non-optimal, So we have steadily decreased the number of people that can come to these sessions, and it's and to the point where, there's 2 or 3 people that can always go, and they're sort of like reliables, and then there are people who can't always come. So when you do the crew call, you just send something out to all of those people, and you say, "Sorry guys, but the first 3 people who respond can come." So that's the only way we've seen to be able to handle it, and actually, it hasn't been a problem, but that's the only way we've been able to figure out what to do about that.
So it's a compromise, right? If your layout doesn't have enough aisle spacing to let traffic move about, You're not going to be able to run as many trains in an efficient manner. And people just aren't, if they're standing around waiting because, you know, so and so is parked in front of you and he's got a switch list full of duties that he has to get done. And, you know, you're trying to squeeze by. It becomes a pain in the neck.
Some of that is prototypical, but it kind of represents the more undesirable aspects of prototype railroading because, you know, some of these crews spend hours just sitting in a cab doing nothing, waiting for clearances. I don't necessarily want to model that.
We, you know, we talk about, you know, the whole hobby, the whole process of building a layout is a compromise in one form or another.
Right.
And, you know, we as HO scale modelers have our own set of compromises, but those compromises multiply in larger scales. For instance, a good friend of mine, a guy that I had known since I was a kid, his name was John Young. He passed away several years ago, was an O scale modeler. And he would hold operating sessions on his O scale layout. So right away, you know, you've got, you know, basements are, you know, on average the same space-wise.
Roughly, yep.
So you've got half because the size of the equipment is double, you've got half the layout in that space.
Yeah.
So his first compromise was to double deck everything. So the upper deck was in the neighborhood of 60 inches off the floor. So that's about at eye level for me, being
That
5'10".
also creates a an aisle density issue that's very difficult to plan for. I know that Tony Custer had written a lot about that when he was building his new layout, and he really did a ton of advanced planning to make sure that he wasn't running into conflicts of, you know, what's above and what's below in terms of operations.
So that's my second point. So when you've got an upper and a lower level, you've potentially got two operators trying to share the same space all the time.
Right.
So now on top of that, because we've compromised with the scale, we haven't gained anything in the size of the basement, and we've added a second level, he's also reduced his aisle space to, in some cases, 20 inches.
Wow.
So
For a quickie pinch point, you can sometimes get away with that, but
oh, no, this was just all the way around. So first of all, you had
no.
a very, very claustrophobic feel to the
Right.
layout. You know, and working that upper level was just painful.
Sure.
Because even though in theory you're at eye level with the locomotives, you're still looking up a lot, which is
Was he
difficult.
taller than you? Because, you know, 2, 3 inches can make a big difference in how you perceive so-called correct layout height, I've found.
No, I would say John was about the same height.
Because, like, when I go up to Mike C's, he's got sections of his layout that are, you know, sort of chest high for me. And if there's not a stool handy, you know, Karen's looking at the fascia. That's
Sure.
all she sees.
Yep. So, you know, that's an extreme case of, I don't know, you know, Bob Leonard would call it stuffing 10 pounds of you know what into
Oh
a
yeah.
5 pound bag.
Yep, my people call it a Magaga bag.
Okay. So you know, you don't have that problem, and
Well, you're saying that, and I think more accurately, haven't had that problem in the past, but I'm aware of the fact that there's some unknowns now that I'm adding Pitston Yard into the mix because that's right behind Mehoopany. And Mehoopany is fully staffed all the time. It's not just, you know, a crew coming through there doing their thing and moving on. There's somebody or a couple of buddies running Mehoopany all the time. So now you're going to add the functions of Pitston Yard basically in that same space. Now it's a nice wide blob, but I have to think that there's going to be some jockeying for position there that may or may not be a problem. I just don't know.
You'll find out soon enough. You had asked me earlier how Dick found the space for this mill,
Yeah, if
because
obviously if you're going into the aisle, there you go.
the mill is substantial. It's approximately 30 inches wide and approximately another 30 inches deep. It's L-shaped, but then it's got, bump outs and additions and all sorts of things. So it ostensibly takes up that whole cube, if you will.
And that's, it's the second dimension that makes it really hard to accommodate on most layouts.
It does, but
It's
so the
also what makes it look
criteria.
really cool, I'll bet.
Well, we had to be careful in the criteria in terms of its design, so that we could get the most operational flexibility out of it, but also so that it fit into the layout, because it dwarfs all of the other structures on the building, on the
Sure,
layout.
sure.
Even the largest structure we did, which was a kitbash of three South River Model Works kits, is teeny tiny compared to this thing. So if you put it next to anything else, it's gonna screw up your sense of selective compression.
Well, P&G at Mahoopany on my layout is like that,
Exactly. That's a perfect
but it has
example.
the advantage of being, on a peninsula by itself.
So we needed to isolate, just like you did with P&G, we needed to isolate this paper mill.
Right.
It couldn't be near any other structure other than its own complex and the structures that go with it. So because we could design the selective compression amongst all of those structures so that they fit in. So what he did was, if you go down the stairs into his basement, to the right is a staging yard. And if you remember that the main line out of the staging yard goes through the concrete wall into the next section of the layout. What he did was he built a hill to work as a scenic divider between the main line tracks, which turn off to the right, and this new branch line that goes straight and goes over the area where he's got a television built into the wall. So he had about the equivalent of a 4 by 8 foot section of real estate that was unbuilt.
Wow,
And then he was able
that's
to,
significant.
it was significant because that 32 square feet is exactly what we needed for this complex.
Right.
And then he wrapped that branch line around the corner. And it takes a right angle turn, and it goes down about another 11 or 12 feet where it serves a feed mill. There's a couple of team tracks down there
Was
that.
it a quick process for him to determine all of this, or is this something that really took you guys some time to sort of hash out?
I think his process with regards to how the bench work was going to be, his concept for what the track work looked like beyond the paper mill, that was all his. And he actually was able to fit a hidden interchange track in there too, which was just pure gold. We spent hours and hours and hours determining how to site this paper mill. How to run the tracks to it, what ancillary structures needed to go with it to support it, what would logically be a part of the complex, and then how we were going to build it. So
Was that
I would.
mostly on the phone because you know the physical plant so well that you could, you didn't have to stand there and look at it?
Most of it was on the phone, but I probably went up there at least a half a dozen times, 4 or 5 hours at a whack,
Right.
just standing on milk crates, looking at it from a bird's eye view, looking at it from a rail fan's view, trying to get a sense of how it all ties in, because
There's no substitute for standing there, I find.
well, taking, empty brass locomotive boxes and stacking them up to try to figure out, all right, well, should this addition be this dimension, and what's that look like? And let's go have lunch and come back and look at it again. And so we went through all of those kind of typical planning processes, and it was time consuming. But with a building that big on that kind of layout, it really needs to be done, because
Be crazy not to do it.
the one common denominator in that layout is that everything looks like it belongs.
Right.
And
And that doesn't happen accidentally.
It doesn't happen accidentally. It's a knack that Dick has, but I didn't want to, first of all, this structure is immense. So and it's right at the bottom of the stairs. So it's the first thing that hits your eye when you get down to the bottom of the stairs. I didn't want it to be a distraction. I wanted it to blend in. I wanted it to look like it belonged on the layout. And my biggest fear was that it looked so big on my workbench that it was going to just overpower everything. And by the time he got done with all of the scenery, and he's a master at weathering structures, it looks like it was one of the first buildings ever built for the layout.
It's very interesting working on something of that scale because, like you were just alluding to, none of your standard techniques for working on something actually apply. When I was building the two plant sections that comprise Mahoopany, it was so big that the only place I could work on it was out in my workshop. That was the
Yep.
only spot that had sufficient real estate. I built a lot of it, I think, on top of my table saw.
Jeez. And yeah, I mean, I had, when I was doing this for a living, I had separate tables that I would build for doing, large oversized structures. When I did that 19 stall version of the South River Model Works brick
Well,
roundhouse.
you had a nice room to work in. That was a very, very spacious room that seemed like it was flexible in terms of how you could use it.
Yeah, there was a lot of open space, so I could bring up tables.
It's more like a studio atmosphere there.
Yeah, it was really nice, and I miss it.
You'll have one again someday.
So that was my surprise for the day, and it morphed into a discussion about Dick's layout. But I also want to talk about, and this is going to turn into a little bit of a rant,
Oh
so
boy.
you'll have to bear with me.
Should I get something to drink?
No, I'm going to need your input on this.
Okay.
As someone who's not a who whose emphasis is not as a structure builder.
Okay.
15 years ago or so, the market for laser cutters fell through the floor. They used to be $40,000, $50,000 machines, and they were originally mass marketed for people who were designing stencils for scrapbookers.
Okay.
And when that hobby died overnight,
Which is such a thing that until I had heard about it, I never even knew it was a thing.
yeah, and I mean, it was a billion-dollar hobby that literally died,
Wow.
within the span of a couple of months. These companies found that they had no place else to market these lasers to, so the prices dropped considerably. They were $20,000 and 15, and now you can buy them for a couple of $1,000.
Anybody who really wants one can have one. It's not
Which
inconceivable.
So all of these folks decided that they wanted to become craftsmen, structure kit manufacturers. And not that that's a bad thing, but there needs to be a level of creativity. Again, a lot of the disciplines that you need to be a successful model railroader, you need to have to be a successful craftsman kit manufacturer.
Yeah, and just because you can do it doesn't mean you should be doing it.
Right. And so they came out of the woodwork, and they were probably, before this drop in the market, there were probably a half a dozen craftsman kit manufacturers. Fine Skill Miniatures was one, South River Model Works, Sierra West, Campbell, it's a name that everybody knows.
Sure.
And they had their own niches. They were successful because they understood the business. They had a great model, and they didn't get beyond themselves. They understood what they could do, what they could reasonably do, and they stuck to that business model.
Well, wasn't it the great philosopher Clint Eastwood who once said,
Well,
"Man's got to know his limitations."
and this is a perfect case of not understanding that, or better yet, not understanding your market or your hobby. So one of the kind of subsections of craftsman kit manufacturers were these people that thought it would be a really good idea because they thought the structures looked cool, were to produce seaside structures. And there was a bazillion of them. And when they first started coming out, and I get it because seaside structures tend to have a lot of character to them. But what's the tie-in with model railroading?
Right.
Sure, there are instances where railroads run to the water, but not on every layout.
Yeah, not a
In
whole lot
fact,
of them. Yep.
on very few layouts. And these kit manufacturers kept pumping them out and pumping them out, and then one by one, they went out of business because they couldn't sell their stuff.
They saturated the market.
You know what, if they each put out one, it would have saturated the market. But they couldn't figure that out because they were so enamored by the looks of these kits and it fit their own personal interest.
Well, I was just going to
So,
say, I mean, I bet half of those folks were doing it because they wanted it, liked it, and needed it. And I mean, if you look at even the few minor unique products that I offer, in all cases, it's because I needed it and nobody made it.
but you weren't looking to sell, 500 of them at $300 a piece.
Well, that's true, and just because someone thought that they could doesn't mean that it was reasonable to assume that.
Right. So, when I became a Craftsman structure kit manufacturer, I took a page out. I copied Bob Van Gelder right down to the T, other than I probably didn't have the skills that Bob has. And Bob's business model was this: one kit a year,
Do it right.
it's a mill, because no matter what, people need mills for their model railroads.
Sure.
They don't need lighthouses, they don't need motif number one in Rockport, because there aren't train tracks near it for 5 miles. So to tie this all in, from time to time I do some contract building, and I got a call from Steve Lamb, who owns a company that builds custom model railroads for folks, and he's got a big project going on and he needed some structures built. So he said, are you interested? And I said, yeah, it's winter, I've got some free time. And he said, let me see what I've got and I'll send it to you. So he sends me this lighthouse kit. And it's not even a lighthouse like on a peninsula or a jetty. It's like on this it's on its own island.
Okay.
And
Did
like
you know that's what he was sending you?
no.
Ah.
And
Because
I
you
don't
would have said probably a lighthouse kit, really?
well, and the interesting thing is it's by a company that's no longer in business.
Okay.
And it's fairly well designed.
Right. It probably looks great when it's built, and then what do you do with it?
Exactly. If I'm modeling Maine, which is where this particular prototype exists, and I don't I'm not really concerned about suspending disbelief. I'll throw this thing down on a layout, but God,
Well, I'm gonna break something to you gently
Yeah.
now, gently.
Okay. Because you're a real subtle guy. Go ahead.
Yeah, not everybody's a prototype modeler.
No, I understand that. I
And
understand.
as a prototype modeler, it's really easy to look at, I look at, like Lehigh Valley ST70 Aces, and I think, oh, come on, really? But somebody is enjoying that, and you know what? More power to them. It's just not what I do. It's not what I'm interested in.
Yep.
So, it's really, really easy to look at something you're not interested in, I think, and say, well, why the hell would anybody do that? Far be it for me to judge. I mean, if the whole purpose of the hobby is to have fun and make yourself happy doing it, and that's your only criteria, and you're actually doing that and you're succeeding at it, good for you. It's just not what I do.
You know, I subscribe to the, you know, it's supposed to be fun and, you know, as long as no one's getting hurt, it's all
Right.
good philosophy about the hobby, but it kind of
Just don't confuse
struck.
it with business if you
It's
know, if your
well, and that's
company
the
is
thing.
bringing
It's
out lighthouse kits and there's no market for it.
it struck me because, you know, as I'm looking at this box and contemplating building it, and you know, was really kind of looking forward to building a mill. So this is all about me. It's all about my own personal disappointment.
Yeah, I get that.
But I thought to myself, you know, how many times did I see this guy at train shows
Oh, really?
packing up everything that he brought with him?
Heartbreaking.
You know, and having him tell me, yeah, we actually lost money because, you know, the tables cost X and the travel
Sure.
cost X. And me biting my tongue because I didn't have the heart to say, look what you've got for structures. They're just so far afield from what people need on their model railroads that even though, Mike, you may not be a prototype modeler, you know, you can still manufacture a generic mill. And, you know, if you've got a little bit of creativity and a little bit of skill, you're going to sell a bunch of them. But, you know, the average modeler is going to look at a lighthouse and say, wow, this really looks great, but I'm not modeling, you know, anything near the ocean. I'm modeling Indiana, Southern Indiana.
It's definitely a niche.
It's a niche within a niche.
It's a notch.
So, you know, when I first got into Craftsman structure manufacturing, Doug Fiscali and I were kind of figuring out one day that about 5% of the entire hobby is interested in building Craftsman structure kits.
Okay.
So let's just say that that's the mainstream kits. That's the mills and, you know, things that are pertinent to model railroading. What percentage is interested in building a lighthouse? And that's who you're marketing to. So all your research dollars, all your production costs are going to market to a tenth of 1%, 1%,
Well, you know,
half a percent.
there's a fairly high percentage of new businesses that fail just, you know, in general, period.
Yeah.
I wonder how that percentage compares to, you know, fledgling model railroad manufacturer businesses. You know, I wonder if it tracks similarly or it's much worse. I don't know the answer to that, but it'd be interesting to compare that.
I'll give you another example because I think that a couple of years ago there was talk that, you know, there are more mom and pop manufacturers now than there ever were in the hobby, and you know, people kind of decry the fact that, well, you know, I remember the day when I could get this and that. It's better now, and I'll use our friend Jimmy Simmons as an example. Jimmy has done a lot of things since he opened his business. He's offered a lot of different types of products, but his kits all center around industry.
Right. I
Because
give him a lot of credit for creativity and maintaining it over time because that's no small thing when you think that he's always in production mode too, right? He's got to keep making and churning out existing product lines. But who else so reliably comes up with something new and interesting on just a regular basis? It's impressive, I think.
He's a fountain of creativity right now, and you know, my hope is that he'll continue that process. It's hard to sustain.
Right. And but he's been doing it for a few years now, hasn't he?
He's been doing it for a few years, and his stuff keeps getting better. He reminds me a lot of Bob Van Gelder in that Bob's kind of philosophy when it came to the next year's kit was, how do I make it better? What can I add to it? What do I improve upon in my past processes that you know, going to keep things fresh?
Right.
And you know, Jimmy has taken that to new levels with his ability to laser cut brick into sheet basswood, which no one's really been able to do successfully before, and even now, you know, all sorts of different patterns and, you know, rock work and cinder block and so on and so forth. Very time consuming and labor intensive and research intensive processes that he had to go through.
He doesn't sleep much, right? That's got to be.
Well, he doesn't, and that's that's something that he inherited from his dad.
That'll catch up with him sooner or later.
He sleeps 3 or 4 hours a night, but
Wow.
his mind is always working.
We said that about Gym 6, remember? It like gives him an unfair advantage, productivity-wise.
Well, I mean, if you can get away with it, you're gonna have a leg up.
Right.
I'm someone who squarely needs 8 hours, and if I don't get it, then I'm not as productive.
I'm about a, 6.5 to 7 hour guy. And then every once in a while, like maybe twice a month, I'll sleep like 10 hours. Just kind of reset and catch up.
If I have a Saturday with nothing to do, you can pretty much find me on the couch. And there are days, at times, I feel guilty about that, although not necessarily in the winter. It's a process of recharging.
Yeah, and I also think as you get a little bit older, as we all desire to do, because it sure beats the alternative. You got to cut yourself a little slack. Eat when you're hungry, sleep when you're tired. It's not a bad philosophy.
Well, and my full-time job is taxing. I just finished a very successful year, and I've been very busy at the start of this year. I come home, I take a look at my personal email, and of late, I've been surprised with the quantity of DVD orders. That requires some fulfillment that I'm more than happy to do. And it's funny, I'll make this my commercial for the podcast. I just ran out of stock of the Making Trees DVD, Mike, which that was I had given 100 to the folks at Scenic Express because they underwrote the production, so that was part of the contractual obligation. So I sold 900 of those DVDs, which I was pretty surprised, because it was kind of an esoteric topic.
Well, you were also competing with their bunch too, right?
Right, which are less expensive. I think they're selling theirs for $19.95, folks. So if you need a Making Trees DVD, go to the Scenic Express website. And but yeah, I, it's been since before Christmas. It's all of a sudden like someone just flipped a switch.
Funny how it goes like that. I mean, it's. And I guess since it's infomercial time, I'll mention that, with the Dartmouth Locomotive Works install side of the thing, I think last time I was talking about the ever-growing backlog, and it is true that, now the stuff just comes in all the time. Like there's always, every couple 3 days there's always a box with two or three engines to do in it. Or somebody's coming by to pick up a bunch that I just did for them. So that's, it's had some nice continuity there. But, I'm one of those guys, if I start looking at this growing backlog, that's not really something I'm comfortable with. It kind of hangs on you. And I'm not crazy about telling people, well, it's going to be 2 months. Because when you start saying that, like I had gotten to the point where I had to put dates on the boxes as they were coming in, so I'd make sure I was taking them in order. And I just thought, really, that it seems like I could do a better job at that. And in the 2 weeks prior to this, like not including this week, but the 2 weeks prior to that, I just went bananas. I just said, I'm just gonna do some installs. And I cranked out more installs in that period than at any time in my business history. I mean, it was well into the high double digits, and just
Jeez.
basically blew away the backlog. Like there's almost none, except my poor friend Chad's steam engine, which I will get back to. It will be no charge. I just have to wait for a day of sufficient self-loathing to finish that project. So,
You shame yourself into doing it.
well, I'm it's also really the least fun you'll have. You know what I mean? It's nothing good about this one. There's a reason it got set aside. That's another a whole other topic.
Sure.
But So it's funny that the other thing that I also did, and forgive me if I already spoke about this, but when I did that big reloc sounding with full throttle files of all of my engines, as I'm going through the cabinet, I found a number of locomotives that I had put aside for another time because they looked like tough installs to me at that time, you know. And as I'm going through this cabinet, I looked at that and I thought, pfft, I could do this in my sleep, and I would just take them out and just do them, you know. So it was kind of gratifying to be able to look back on some of those and say, well, I guess I am learning something here, you know, because when it's so incremental over time, you know, it's like you don't notice it. You know, it's like looking at your grandson every 6 weeks instead of every day. You know, you see massive differences.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. With that in mind, folks, you can go to my website, or you can click on the link on the podcast page, as is the case with Mike. Take a look at what we have to offer. Hey, lastly, Mike, this month, we just got an announcement yesterday from Norm Wolf that unfortunately the Mid-Atlantic Regional Prototype Modelers Meet, which has been held for the last 5 years in Fredericksburg, Virginia, is canceled this year.
Yeah, I felt really
And
bad when I saw that, because Norm is such a nice guy, and oh yeah, you just look at that and you just say, well, the hotel screwed him. There's no other way to look at it, and it happens.
It's a funny thing. First of all, Norm is a very thoughtful, detail-oriented guy, and first and foremost, he strives to make sure that anybody who attends one of his shows has a great time and it's economical. And he is a true lover of this hobby, and everything he does with regards to it shows that. And I give him a lot of credit, as I know you do, Mike, for putting on this show. We've been there, done that, and it's a miserable experience.
Yeah, I did say to him, and actually, I don't think I said it privately. Not that I think about it, but I said, you know, I really don't know why anybody would do it, because it's so much work for so comparatively little return. And I don't mean just monetarily, because you can forget monetarily, but it's just so much work that it's truly a labor of love, you know. And maybe in my case, I just have so many irons in the fire that I can't ever imagine having the kind of so-called spare time to even think about doing something like that.
Sure. And I don't, this particular hotel, and I've been to this show a couple of times. I don't quite understand why this hotel would give away this time frame on him. It's not a great hotel. It's an average hotel. It's an economical hotel, and that's why he chooses it. It's in an area where there's a bazillion other hotels just like it.
You think they'd want a reliable customer every year at
Sure,
that time, yeah.
someone they could count on every year. And by the way, he was bringing in 150 or so people, into the hotel for 2 or 3 nights
Right. So
every
something
year.
changed, whether it was management or some other more lucrative, reliable gig, or who knows.
Well, he had had issues in past years with them too. So this wasn't the first time, but I guess this was the most egregious. And one he couldn't.
I think what Mike Brock found down in Cocoa Beach was there's a lot to be gained from contacting a hotel, cultivating a relationship, and more importantly, working with them to understand, you know, what it would take to be important to that hotel. I think in Mike's case, you know, that they told him that there was a like a lull weekend reliably after the holidays, before things ramped up for the season, and that if he could commit to doing something at that time, they could really work with him, you know. So I think that's what you have to do, you know. You have to find some angle that makes it work somehow.
Well, and I think in Mike's case too, he's in an area that is very seasonal,
Right.
and this is a Hilton hotel, so certainly an organization like Hilton is going to understand the importance of bringing in a group off season.
Oh yeah, and you know, to their credit, I mean, that hotel had a very professional and cooperative staff, and I think Mike lucked out there, in that regard. He might still be looking for a place if he hadn't stumbled upon that particular one. But I think it can be done, and I think you have to take that approach.
Yep. No, absolutely. And I think if Norm wants to carry on with this, I think he can rebound because he's the type of diligent guy that will make sure it happens.
It's a shame he had to miss a year,
But it's
that's.
yeah, I mean it's a shame that any company would do that to someone that's trying to hand them money. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But it was unfortunate. These prototype modelers meets tend to be smaller, more intimate conventions where learning is paramount to vendor sales and that sort of thing. It's
Right.
less of a circus and more of an education. And I know I could probably speak for you, Mike, in that we of all the different types of shows and conventions that we go to and do clinics at, those are the best.
There's no question about it. In fact, that's really the only ones I've ended up attending after, all of this time. I was trying to one time count up the number of those meets that I'd been to and done clinics at, and after taking a good stab at it, I realized I just can't. I mean, I really, you get like up into the 70s, and then it all turns into a blur. And I really just I don't think there's any way for me to know how many of those things I've done over time.
Sure.
I think it. I think it. It probably speaks to why I've got some personal feelings of burnout on meats in general, and maybe that's a topic for the next time we talk about all of this. But it's something that it'd probably be worth exploring. Like a meat therapy session from Mike.
Well, I've adopted your philosophy, just say no. And I've had in the past 6 months, two offers to do clinics at NMRA national conventions.
Right.
And the answer is thank you very much for your offer. I appreciate you thinking of me, but no. And it has nothing to do with the convention or the people putting on the convention or even my desire to ham it up and do a clinic.
Right. I got just a similar request. I think it was this week from the folks that do the Pittsburgh area proto meet. And I have been there two or three times and just thoroughly enjoyed it every time because it's a once again a great bunch of people who do an excellent job at putting on the meet. It's in Pennsylvania, which is my modeling state, you know what I mean? And it's basically all good except for the fact that it's in Pittsburgh, you know what I mean? Which is nowhere near me. And these days I'm just much less inclined to mount a campaign to go out there. In fact, I think the last time I did that meet, I wasn't married to Karen yet. She was in New York, and I was, we were dating. And I think what I did was take the train to New York, and I took the train the next day out of Penn Station to, I guess I went to Philly, and then across the whole state. And I just kind of did that for partly for the adventure of it, because I'd never ridden on a passenger train across. The state of Pennsylvania, and it was nice, going, and a lot less nice coming home because that was at night, so
Sure.
you didn't see anything.
Yep.
And as I recall, that particular trip, I just kept getting whacked in the head by college students with laundry baskets. So that's my memory of the trip home on that particular train. Who knew, that laundry students carried. I mean, laundry students, that college students carried laundry baskets full of their clothes home to be washed
On the train.
on the train.
Yeah, go
So
figure.
my advice is don't take an aisle seat, on that kind of a train.
Yeah. our best to Norm, and we hope this isn't the end of the Mid-Atlantic Regional Prototype Modelers meet, and
Well,
we'll.
if I know my norms, he'll bounce back and come back with something better.
I agree. I agree, Mike. That's all I've got this month. How about you?
Yeah, me too. I'm worn out from all this electrical debug, so hopefully you'll get a more energetic me next time around.
All right, folks, we'll talk to you next month.